everyone. My name's Vashti. I'm a member of Socialist Alternative from Melbourne, and I'm just going to help chair and kind of facilitate the discussion, which will happen after the introduction. So hopefully by now you all know that you're at the Socialism Conference in Sydney. Yep. Okay, that's good. That's the first hurdle that we all seem to have jumped over. And this session that we're talking about today is what is social class and why is it still relevant? The person who'll be giving the talk is Maura Leahy. She's a British socialist who now lives in Australia. She's been involved in numerous different struggles for political and economic justice. She was involved in Britain in the fight against the Nazis there. She was involved in student politics for a long time and is now here and has been involved in a number of different trade union and other social struggles. So please make her welcome, and then after she speaks, we'll have time for discussion. All right.
Thanks, Vashti. In 2015, academics at Australian National University in Canberra published research that was called Class, Capital and Identity in Australian Society. And what this kind of research says is that social class is really complicated to understand, and that social class in Australia today is much more fractured than at any other time. And they kind of... Wrong slide. That's that. I don't know if I've got the slide I was going to use. No, no. There it is, there it is. You wouldn't think I was a teacher. And what they said is this is, when you look at Australia today, this is how we would divide social class. And actually their research was based on similar research in the UK in 2013 that really comes across the commonly held view of class, that it's about occupation, it's about your levels of education. And the kind of new element of this research was building on the 80s sociologist Pierre Bourdieu that said it's also about your cultural capital. Crudely, really, whether you prefer opera or AFL, and this determines your social class. And that social class is very complicated. And your social capital, who you mixed with, and also self-perception and interviews. And my lovely friend Stuart, who's in the audience, pointed to me about this podcast that the ABC did based on this research called The Class Act. And that interviewed the researchers from ANU and a range of other people to talk to them about their class. And actually, the thing that struck me about it is it brought out the kind of worst aspects of competitiveness and individualism at the heart of capitalist society. That class is about a value judgment of how well you've done and how you've pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. And that really to be working class is something bad, and that we've all got to aspire to be upper class and that's good. And Australia is some kind of meritocracy. And as I listen to more and more of this four-part podcast, nearly throwing my mobile out of the car window one day, what struck me about it was really how superficial it was, incredibly subjective, and ultimately, actually, anti-working class. You know, the researchers, for example, and this was in the podcast, asked people about whether or not they watched reality TV and then made a calculation as to whether they watched Love Island, ironically or not, to help determine their class. Clearly, irony is meant to be the preserve of the educated middle class and upper class. I think these people have never met a group of Sydney private school educated Liberal Party North Shore boys out on a Saturday night. I think what the findings reflect, and the reason I've talked about it, is really general ideas in society about class. That a Marxist approach to class, to talk about class, is too simplistic. That really, in the West, we're all middle class now, and there's a whole meeting about that that people can go to or hear about. And that social class is about how you perceive yourself. And actually, the reason we don't have working class struggle is because people perceive themselves as being middle class. And what I want to do today is talk about three things. I want to explain a Marxist view of class. I want to explain why the working class power has changed the world. And within that, I want to dispel some of the myths about the working class today. I'm not sure I'm going to get time to do the third one enough. So starting with the Marxist view of class. For Marxists, social class is objective. It isn't subjective. It's not about what you think about yourself or how many Apple products you own or whether you've got a degree. It's about where you stand in relation to how wealth is created in society and where you stand in relationship to those who control wealth and those who are forced to work to survive. Marxists think that classes have existed really for only a tiny part of human society, approximately 10,000 years of over 500,000 years. They rose when human society advanced to the point where groups of human could produce more food than they needed to live collectively and cooperatively up to at this point in history. The rise of a surplus of food and resources that meant that humans had more than they just needed to survive created the need to store it against disasters, against the precariousness of existence, to defend it and exchange it. And over contested time, this wasn't a straightforward process. This controlling society of that surplus became that of a minority. And over hundreds of years, that minority became cut off from the rest and developed rules, laws, and became a separate ruling class. And in that description of class, from the beginning, class is about relationship. It's about your relationship to the control of surplus in society and your relationship to other key classes in society. And Marx argued that the key divide in all class societies is that of two great contending classes. And those contending classes are the key classes that make any class society function. And the growth of human civilization was absolutely dependent on the exploitation of one key class in society by another, and thus by the struggles between them for power in that society. And this view of history that Marx put forward is different to most views of history because it's a dynamic one. It isn't one that says, this is the world as it is now, and that's how it's always been, and that's how it will always be. It's a view of history that puts collective human activity at the centre of the explanation. When there's a growth of new forces of production in society, and what Marx meant by that was the tools we use, the methods we have of creating goods, the ways we transport them, that has led to the development of new classes inside of existing society, or inside of the way that this existing society is organised, what Marx called the mode of production. And that has led to conflict. The obvious one is inside of feudalism, you got the growth of the bourgeoisie, and that led to revolutions in England, France, Holland, etc., that led to the domination of capitalism, the rise of a new social order. And that the bourgeoisie class grew to power, you know, to the point of challenging feudalism, and in many cases actually chopped the heads off the old feudal rulers to get control of society. The key dynamic in the system today is that we live in a class society where wealth is created by the exploitation of the labour of the working class, and that wealth is concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority who control it in their interests. And that is as true today as when Marx first wrote about this in the 1840s. And actually, in the last 25 years, as other people have said in this conference so far, that gap between the rich and poor, between those who control and own production and those who do the work, has grown. So, for example, the OECD estimates that in advanced Western economies that working class wages are 13% down in as a proportion of GDP compared to 1995. What's interesting about capitalism and different, and why Marx recognised the dynamism of the system, is that for the first time in the last 10,000 years of human history, where the surplus has existed, we do now have a surplus that is sufficient, and the potential is even greater, that we can have a world that meets the needs of the whole of society. That's one of the things that is so sick about capitalism. We don't need to have poverty. We don't need to have inequality. The capitalist class control the means of production, the tools, the machinery, technology, and they amass their wealth from the exploitation of the labour of the working class. And we use exploitation as a term a lot in society. In Marxism, it's got a very specific meaning. And that specific meaning is that the capitalists gain more value from the labour we put in by going to work than they pay out in wages. And Marx talks about this being a relationship because under capitalism, we are dependent on the capitalist class to sell our labour power. The capitalists are dependent on us selling our labour power to describe. And in Capital, Marx said this, that capital is dead labour, which vampire-like lives only by sucking living labour and lives the more labour it sucks. And I think that's a beautiful description of the process of capitalism, sucking our labour. And you feel it more and more in the world, don't you? I mean, when I was a kid, everybody said that we'd be working 3 or 4 days a week and working 4 hours a day. I'm working longer hours than I did ever I was going to say the 1920s. In my 20s. In my 20s, which was not in the 1920s. And I think it is a great quote because it shows that the capitalists can only survive with the working class as the blood to suck on. It's a relationship. It is not one where these classes can exist separately. For Marxists, we look to the working class as the potential force for change in society and as the class that can actually end class society because we do have the means for everybody to live a much better life, that as the class that produces all the value in society, it has the potential to do that in the interests of the whole of humanity. And it has the power to seize control from the capitalist minority who rule only for their short-term gain. Irrespective of the impact on climate change, the destruction of billions of products every year to keep prices high. I mean, 2 weeks ago, there was that article about Burberry bags. I'm not bothered about them myself. But actually, that's the absolute tip of the iceberg of what the capitalist class does to goods that are produced in society in order to keep prices high because their system is based on profit, not human need. We don't necessarily look to the working class as the force for change because we think they're all great now or because they are the most oppressed class in society. But it's the potential we have as the people who produce all the wealth in society to create a new world through that collective power. And there's a number of myths about class, and I am going to try and deal with a few of them as I go. And, you know, one is that, you know, class is not relevant today, that these figures show that, you know, actually people don't think about themselves in their terms. The reality is class shapes our lives from the cradle to the grave. How long your life is determined by what class you are born into. So in 2011, there was a study in Australia called Deaths, Dollars and Degrees that suggests there is a life expectancy gap of 6 years between the richest and the poorest inside of Australia. When it comes to schooling, God, it makes me really laugh as a Brit. Everyone goes on about, oh, you still have classes in Britain, but you don't have them in Australia. You look at the Australian schooling system, and that tells you that you live in a class society. In Britain, 7% of the population go to private school. In Canada, it's 8. In America, it's 10%. In Australia, in secondary schools, it's in Sydney, 40% of students go to private schools. And you should see the swimming pools that they have in places like Loretto Killabilly, Knox Grammar, etc. They don't have those in the state schools in Western Sydney, for example. I've digressed because I've started thinking about schools. There was an article, a recent report in Red Flag, actually, that said 2 out of every 3 Commonwealth dollars that is spent on schooling in New South Wales is spent goes to private school. In terms of health, if you're working class, you're more likely to get cancer and die from it. You're more likely to get heart disease and die from it. You're more likely to suffer from all kinds of illnesses. And we know, don't we, and a number of people at this conference have referenced it, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And this is linked to an Oxfam report that came out recently. The second myth is that actually the working class is a much smaller force in society than it was. When Marx was writing the Communist Manifesto, there was about 20 million workers across the world. They were largely in Northern Europe and bits of the USA. In 2013, the International Labour Organization said the world had reached a tipping point, that for the first time in human history, wage labourers outnumbered all other classes they took over from the peasantry as the biggest class in human society, and that today workers are 1.6 billion worldwide. Now, just to be clear, Marx wasn't predicating his argument on the fact that workers would be the biggest class. It was the power they had as the producers of wealth inside of society. But actually, far from being a shrinking working class, the working class is more global than ever. In Australia, far from having a shrinking working class, there's been an absolute growth of numbers from over 7 million workers in 1998 to 12.5 million in 2018. There's been a drop in manufacturing, and I'll say something about that in a minute. But there's more than double workers over 20 years in construction, mining, education, retail and training. In healthcare, there's almost three times as many workers as 20 years ago. And some Australian Marxists, Tom Bramble and Rick Kuhn, argue that 70% of the population are working class, 20% middle class, 10% ruling class. Manufacturing has declined in the richest countries of the world. And from that, you know, many people draw conclusions that means class is either outdated or needs refining, such as by the researchers from the ANU. I'm not trying to dismiss the loss of manufacturing jobs in Australia, Britain, USA or elsewhere, and certainly not the struggles of people against them. You know, in my own political life, there is a massive formative impact, the 1985 miners' strike in Britain, on my own politics, the struggles of working people to stop the destruction of the mining industry. But I think it is really important not to overstate it either, that manufacturing is still 16% of output in most developed countries. It was never more than 50% in any country in the world. And workers in manufacturing might be smaller numbers, but in many cases they have more power than ever. So, for example, a strike at the Rico Auto Parts factory in India in 2019 stopped operations of Ford in Canada, in Michigan, for a week. Because of the nature of capitalism and the interrelatedness of the world, it means that, and just-in-time methods and things like that, it means workers have more power than ever. As I said, the working class is a worldwide class. The number of industrial workers across the world grew from 533 million in 1999 to 724 million in 2018. And parts of the world where the working class have grown have seen the sorts of class struggle we know is endemic to capitalism. There was a great article in Jacobin from 2012 called China as undeniably the epicentre of global labour unrest. And I'd really urge people to look at things like the China Labour Bulletin to see the explosion of class struggle that has taken place in places like China. There's a brilliant Paul Mason book. I don't like all his books, but there's a brilliant book called Live Working or Die Fighting, which looks at different workers in the developing parts of the world and sees the development of working class struggle. White collar workers often argued that, you know, they're not real workers. They are absolutely essential part of the working class today. If you think about financial sectors and coal sectors, public sector workers are essential to the creation of surplus value in the system of the whole. The revolutionary nature of capitalism means that there is always need for more and more educated workers. If you think, if 1 million, near the 900,000 education workers in Australia go on strike, that has a massive impact on the economy in terms of childcare and things like that. In Sydney, we've had strikes by childcare workers, people, some of the lowest paid workers, and that's massively impacted the rest of the economy because capitalism needs those childcare workers to look after children while other people go out to work. Ernest Mandel, the Hungarian Marxist, said this about when he talked about the nature of the working class and said it was never just about manufacturing, it's about your relationship to how wealth is produced in society as a whole. And he said, the defining structural characteristics of the proletariat in Marx's analysis of capitalism is the socio-economic compulsion to sell one's labour power. Included in the proletariat, then, are not only manual industrial workers, but all unproductive wage labourers who are subject to the same fundamental constraints. Non-ownership of the means of production, lack of direct access to the means of livelihood, insufficient money to purchase the means of livelihood without more or less continuous sale of labour power. What's so different about the working class as a class in society compared to all other oppressed classes, and why the working class has the power to change the world, is that the working class by its nature is a collective class. We are drawn together to work like no other class in the whole of human history. And I had like loads of kind of figures that I'm not going to go into, but I'll just show you a couple of pictures. So we see that actually across the world, we're getting increasing massive workplaces like this. In the USA, for example, 20% of workers work in places of over 500 workers. There's these massive logistic hubs, which I thought I had a picture of, maybe I don't, growing up all over America. There you go, there's a picture of the massive logistic places that are happening, transport hubs and things like that. In the one in Chicago area alone, over 150,000 workers work in that area. There are 60 major logistic hubs around the USA that have over 50,000 workers. The Foxconn production complex in Shenzhen in China that produces Apple products has 300,000 workers in 15 factories across 3 square miles and is effectively a city in itself. Here in Sydney, you know, the airport has 38,000 workers in direct employ and another 22,000 on site. The Star Casino, just down the road, has over 3,000 workers. Sydney Uni has over 5,000 workers. The RPA Hospital, over 4,000 workers. And we know about the Amazon fulfillment centres, and I'll come back to those in a minute. In most cases, they employ over 1,000 workers. And so the working class is brought together. We can't just say, I want my bit from the bosses, like the peasants, so I'm going to take my land. I'm going to have my little bit of Sydney Airport to take home with me. We have to fight together if we want to change things and make a difference. You know, we can't take home those little bits of capital that we work on. And the capitalist system is one that constantly tries to squeeze more and more out of us. And you can see that really clearly in those horror stories about the Amazon logistics centres, etc. People wearing those bracelets, timing every movement they're doing. And I read one thing about Amazon workers in France and the UK have to process 300 items in 1 hour period. So much for that image from the 60s and 70s of us working less and having a better quality of life. And I think just because the working class isn't winning the class struggle at the minute, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have the potential to do so. Nor that working class people do not see the need for self-organisation. There was a 2015 poll where 62% of Australians think that unions are important for the Australian working class people today. You get a lot of arguments, don't you, that actually the working class has fundamentally changed, things are different. I'm sure people can talk about it in discussion. Just a couple of quick ones that I want to deal with. One is that we all work for Uber now and we're all doing Airtasker and stuff like that. I mean, in my dad's day, it was called moonlighting. Yeah. My dad was a bus driver, and on a Saturday night, we had a Volkswagen van, because I've got 10 brothers and sisters. And he had a Volkswagen van, and on a Saturday night, he would take people to their hen parties in Blackpool and bring them back and earn a bit of cash on the side. We all see the little cards that used to be in shop windows of people advertising their services. Yeah. Just because people advertise that now on the internet, it doesn't mean the nature of work has fundamentally changed. Less than 1% of adults in Australia, America and elsewhere make their prime earnings from these kind of labour platforms. There's a really interesting thing that people talk about feeling precarious all the time. The simple statistic is that casualisation has not increased in Australia in the last 20 years. It was a quarter of the workforce in 1998. It's a quarter of the workforce in 2018. And a third of casuals work 5 days a week in Australia, and a quarter of them expect to be working for the same employer in a year's time. On average, they're employed for 4 years inside of a job. And there's a fantastic book by Kim Moody, an American socialist, who's written this book called On New Terrain that talks about the changing working class. And he talks about the fact that it's this myth that in the past you had a job for life. In the USA, the average number of jobs held by people between the ages of 18 and 44 between 1978 and 2008 is 11 over the course of their life, regardless of their gender, age or class. It's not true that this is something that has really changed in the last 10 or 15 years. Because capitalism is a dynamic system, there is the realignment of the working class. It does change, it does develop. And the point for our side is that we have to organise those workers in the same way that people had to in the 1890s, that they did during and after World War I in Australia, in the 1930s, the 1960s and the 70s. And, you know, you can organise those workers. I was listening to a talk by somebody who was talking about the rail unions in Australia. And in the 1990s, less than 10% of workers in the rail unions were union members. It's now something like 90% because of the conscious efforts of socialists and trade unionists to organise that. You do see some of the potential to organise a lot of the new workers in recent strikes that have taken place. So, for example, the Amazon... I'm sorry, I've done these all in order. The recent Amazon workers' strike, taking coordinated action across Germany, Italy and Spain. Absolutely brilliant. The strikes for equal pay in Spain of over 5 million workers on International Women's Day. There's been Deliveroo strikes in London. There's a great little video I don't have time to show you. All these Deliveroo drivers driving around the streets of London on their bikes in a convoy as part of the strike. You've had strikes of McDonald's workers in America and Britain striking for decent pay. And there have been, you know, here in Australia, unionisation and small strikes in warehousing chains that supply Coles, Woolworths, elsewhere. The reason why we've not got more of that is not something fundamental to the working class. It's about the history of what has happened in the last 20, 30 years inside of Australia, the impact of neoliberalism, and I would crucially argue the impact of the accord and the social contracts in Britain and elsewhere that impacted on workers' ability to fight. And the working class today, as always, is not just, you know, it never was just white men who work on building sites. It is men, it is women, it is black, white, it is Hispanic, it is Asian, it is multinational. And capitalism works really hard, because it has to stop our side fighting and thinking that we can fight and win. Bob Crowe, this union leader in Britain who died a few years ago, who was a socialist and the leader of the rail workers, used to always say that if we all spat together, we could drown them. And in order to stop us doing that, not spitting, I think it's disgusting. It's like chewing gum in your classroom. It's a no-no. Capitalism does work really hard to stop our side fighting and thinking we can fight. It uses war, oppression, racism, nationalism to divide us, to make us think that those are the divisions in society that matter, our gender or our nationality, not the fact that we are workers and they are the bosses. And I think in particular, oppression is absolutely central to the maintenance of capitalism. You know, there are economic benefits to oppression for the system as a whole. As Gavin said last night in the opening rally, capitalism came into the world dripping in the blood of slavery, racism and colonialism. Women's oppression in its changing forms has been absolutely central to the privatisation of reproduction for workers for everyday life and future generations. And there are key political functions in oppression as well, of dividing us and obscuring class division. If you think about, you know, anti-Islam, Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism, it's a really good example of a tool that has been used in Australia to justify imperialism and domestic political power play. And those divisions have to be powerful because they weaken our ability to end the system that creates both exploitation and oppression and relies on both of them hand in hand to keep going. And that's why, you know, the final thing I want to say is why class struggle is so important. Because actually, we do have the potential to have a different world. It's only when people begin to fight that they can see that that potential can exist. But they begin to understand that the boss class isn't the boss class because they're more capable than us, that they've got special skills that we don't have, that actually they need us more than we need them. As somebody said last night, you could see that really clearly for the rail workers in Sydney, when a one-day strike would have cost the bosses $100 million. And also, the fact of us struggling collectively, that is the way that we achieve better conditions, pay and dignity. And ultimately, it's that collective struggle that can give us control over our labour and value. And we need the unity to do that. And it's self-activity that creates the conditions in which it's really possible to break down the influence of those real divisions that exist in society amongst us. And it's also absolutely necessary to do that. Lenin called revolutions the festival of the oppressed. He talked about how self-activity by people to begin to fight against the injustices of the world often brings to the fore the most oppressed people in society as the leaders of that struggle. So famously, the Russian Revolution in February 1917 was sparked by women textile workers in perhaps what was the most renowned anti-Semitic country in Europe at the time, in Russia. Many of the leaders of the revolution were Jews, including Trotsky, who led even in 1905 revolution, when the Black Hundreds were trying to produce pogroms against workers and whip up racism. At the same time, the leader of the Petrograd Soviet in 1905 was Trotsky, who was a Jew. But even smaller struggles, not just revolutions, open up the chance for the most political, most conscious socialists and activists to build the political consciousness amongst the wider working class to challenge every manifestation of oppression and injustice. And I love that idea about talking about revolution as a festival, because actually every single major outbreak of struggle has produced a flowering of art, literature, creativity, unity. It has produced confidence from the fight that fighting and winning brings. It brings an openness to radicalism and a rejection of the dominant ideas of capitalism. When we have no power, people can be pulled in the ideas that the problem is immigrants, that politics and economics are so difficult and complex that we need the rulers to rule for us. We're not in that situation in Australia today, but it is the case that, as Marx said, the struggle, it is a constant struggle, the class struggle, but it will once again become now open on our side, that there will be times when our class begins to fight and fight back. As he famously said in the manifesto, the history of capitalism is the history of class struggle. And the working class in capitalism has been the most oppressed class in history that has fought and won because it is a collective class. As Marx said, capitalism creates its own grave digger. And in my own lifetime, slightly longer than my life, just about, this is some of the key high points of struggle that have happened. So just to finish, I think class is relevant today because exploitation is worldwide and the working class has the potential power to change the world. The working class will again exercise that power. And the role of socialists is to be both patient about that and also impatient, to understand the objective situation we're in will change and that we need to build our side and our conscious organisers and fighters and people who stand up and fight against oppression and fight to ferment every opportunity to unite workers. Because those opportunities to raise the banner of working class struggle will happen, and our role is to develop and deepen those struggles where and whenever they take place. Thank you.